From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at why transgender rights and issues have shown up in some ads in the state Supreme Court race. Then, we'll learn how proposed federal cuts could impact the fight against the HIV epidemic.
Now is not the time to go backwards and set us back decades as we try and reach a goal that I think everyone, regardless of political affiliation, would agree is a noble goal.
Plus, we'll explore the Milwaukee Public Library's Zine Collection, which celebrates DIY creativity.
When it comes to modern zines, it is, I'm going to put out this idea so that I can control what's being said, I can make sure to express myself, and no one can tell me, no, that's not what we're going to publish.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Wisconsin voters will elect a new state Supreme Court justice tomorrow. Some of the top issues in the race are criminal justice, abortion, and redistricting. But another topic has crept into ads in the tail end of this race: transgender rights. Conservative-backed candidate Judge Brad Schimel's campaign is running ads about transgender issues, attacking liberal-backed candidate Judge Susan Crawford. To find out more about that, WUWM's Mayan Silver is joined by Erin Reed, a transgender journalist. She's been covering LGBTQ legislation around the country for several years.
So have you been following at all the Wisconsin Supreme Court race?
I'm aware of it, and I know that there has been a lot of anti-trans ad spend in that particular court race. I will say, given the breadth of attacks on transgender people across the United States, it is one single data point in a large sea of similar fights that are going on across the United States.
So I saw your interview with PBS ahead of the November 2024 election, and you were talking about how during a two-week period in October, you calculated that nearly 40% of the ads that were supportive of current President Donald Trump were anti-trans ads. Is that correct?
So that was not my calculation, but it was a calculation that that I had seen that was well-sourced by one of the large ad agencies. What I will say is that in the aftermath of the election, there was good reporting put out by the Washington Post and a number of other media outlets showing that the ad spend on anti-trans ads was $240 million, which was by far more than any other ad type combined.
I see. Okay. And you had kind of talked about it as a fear campaign. Is it unprecedented for the trans community? Have you ever seen anything like that before?
Never. The first anti-trans ad was in 2019. It was a sports ad against Governor Andy Beshear in Kentucky. He won that election, I will say. They figured that the ads wouldn't work very well. They tried to deploy them in a couple other elections and they didn't work. But it was really in the 2024 election where they spent a large amount of money on those ads.
Do you think that any other minority or marginalized community, those types of ads would fly? Like, let's say these were, I'm Jewish, so let's say these were like anti-Jewish ads, or let's say these were like undocumented immigrants get the same sort of vitriol, but yeah, what do you think?
What I was going to say was that the only other group that I saw ads at that level were immigrants. And what I will say is that, interestingly enough, in a lot of the Senate races, they combined anti-trans ads and anti-immigrant ads, where they would hit like three issues, and it would be, we'll let your kids in bathrooms with men, and we'll let undocumented immigrants flood into your communities. And so often that is how I would see them sort of back-to-back. And as we've seen in the Trump administration, trans people and immigrants are the ones that are getting some of the heightened targets right now.
So what do you want people to know about this? Before I ask you about some of the Supreme Court messaging, like, what do you want? Yeah, how should people be reacting to this?
Well, so one thing that I'll say is that, you know, the ads themselves, they definitely use very incendiary language. They are designed to breed more hate and contempt towards the transgender community. But what I will also say is that in the aftermath of the ads, you know, during the presidential cycle, the ads were primarily on things like sports and whatnot. But whenever you actually see the policies that they implement, whenever they take power, right now, trans people are having trouble getting passports. Right now, trans people are being having their driver's licenses revoked and sent old licenses. Right now, trans people are being told that they are inherently undisciplined and dishonorable and therefore not worthy of being part of the military, which is the ban actually uses that language. And so what I want to caution to people who listen to these ads and who might say, oh, well, maybe I feel a little bit weird about trans people in sports. Look at what they're actually doing. You know, the harm is heavy here.
So we're talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, and for a short period ahead of the election, the Schimmel campaign, that's the conservative-backed candidate, was airing an ad featuring a woman who says she's, quote, not okay with trans issues affecting young people. And an unknown group was sending out text messages that said that, quote, unquote, parental rights is something the court could take up. Currently, the issue is not even before the court. What do you make of this?
Yes, so I have one specific and one general thing to say about that. The specific thing is that whenever it comes to transgender teenagers in school, you know, a lot of times, if you read the Trevor Project research, it shows that the place that most trans people feel most safe to come out to at first is to their peers in their classrooms and to at least one teacher that might be a trusted mentor. Trans people, you know, often feel more safe there than in their home environments. And what I will also say is that transgender people have some of the highest rates of abuse, of neglect, of going homeless. The homeless youth population is 40% LGBTQ. And that shows why it's important to not forcibly out LGBTQ kids to their parents whenever they come out to, you know, a friend or a teacher or a counselor. Let them come out on their own time. That was important for me. It was important for a lot of people. The other thing that I'll say more generally is that the reason why they're focused so hard on this race, on the Supreme Court race, is because we've actually seen in some states, the state Supreme Court has been stronger than the federal Supreme Court whenever it comes to protections for LGBTQ people. We just saw in Montana, for instance, where they passed a slew of anti-LGBTQ legislation, anti-trans legislation. A drag ban was one of the things that they had passed in Montana. And the first person that that drag ban was enforced against was a transgender public speaker speaking about about history in a library, so not even a drag artist. And the state Supreme Court there stepped in and said, no, like this goes against our state constitution. And so state Supreme Courts are often the bulwark of defense against an encroachment of rights. We saw this actually in the gay marriage fight back in 2004. If you remember the gay marriage fight, the way that we ended up getting legalization of gay marriage is because at first it was state Supreme Courts that said that gay people can get married in this state. And if they can get married in one state, then they can travel to other states and also have that marriage recognized. And that's how we got the whole fight over gay marriage. So state Supreme Court fights are very important.
What's your take on the conservative-backed candidate in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race relying on some of this messaging at points in his campaign?
Yeah, so I think that what's really interesting is that whenever you do research and polling on transgender issues, while people have a variety of opinions on various topics like sports and healthcare and all these other things, if you ask them to rate how far on their list they rate it, like if it's something that's really important to them versus something that is not very important to them, it's always the last place issue. It's always the issue that nobody really cares about on a personal level. And so the question is why put out ads and like why be obsessed with transgender people in your political campaign? And the answer that we have found is not because it's effective on the individual level. It's because it will get you tons and tons of money. And so that's what we see. We see campaigns now, like the Supreme Court race right now, have billionaires come in, flood the market with anti-trans ads, as well as other ads, because now they want that candidate to win. And then all of a sudden, you've got a ton of money that you've got to work with. And that's why we see it.
It seems like these anti-trans ads in this particular race started coming out like in the very immediate weeks before the election. Like, do you see any sort of strategy in that?
Timing, I'm not particularly certain. I know in the national races, in the Senate races, the first anti-trans ads started coming in about a month and a half before the election, which was still like really close to the election. It was a strategy that they had pulled at the last moment. And I know that we just had Donald Trump say, oh, just like run this like a week with run this whenever there's only a week left until the election is there, and then you're going to get everybody. And I think, again, this is just exactly the same kind of politics of fear that we see from the administration. It's the same kind of politics of fear that we see from certain members of the further right echelons of the Republican Party. And I think that we're probably seeing that in this race as well. I hope, my hope is that people see what is actually being done to LGBTQ people and actually being done to transgender people versus the rhetoric that they see in the ads, and that hopefully blunts the impact of some of these ads in the future, because what we're actually seeing in the community is, you know, far worse than even anything that you see in the ads.
I'm wondering about sort of the mainstreaming of this issue, like legitimizing this issue as a political issue. Is that problematic in and of itself?
I wholeheartedly agree, and I think that it's really tough as a member of the transgender community to just try to live your life and to see everybody, to see tens of millions of dollars flying left and right trying to demonize you for who you are. What I will say, though, is that you just mentioned abortion and then transgender issues, and these issues are interconnected. Like, these issues are not something that are divorced from one another. The same rulings in the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, targeting abortion are also being used in the transgender rulings, are also being used to advocate against birth control. And we also see it used in the fight over antidepressants now, with RFK Jr. Trying to make it so that antidepressants aren't something that get prescribed. And so what you'll often see in these Supreme Court fights, in these judicial fights, is that the trans issue is just one facet of a large number of issues that they want to consolidate power on using the same arguments. They're going to say, for instance, that that a transgender person is too young to get gender-affirming care at the age of 18, and they're going to take that court ruling that they get out of that, and they're going to say also that somebody under the age of 18 is too young to have birth control, and they're going to use the same exact rationale. They're going to say that that abortion is something that should continue to remain illegal because there's not a longstanding history and tradition of allowing abortions. And they're going to use that same ruling in the transgender cases. And so I think that they're trying to build jurisprudence here that doesn't only affect the transgender community. It affects all of our communities.
Aaron Reed, thank you so much for speaking with me about this important topic.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on.
Aaron Reed is a journalist who covers transgender issues. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. For information about what you'll see on your ballot at tomorrow's election, visit our voter guide at WUWM.com. The Trump administration has been slashing federally funded institutions and programs. Recently, that came to include proposed cuts to the Center for Disease Control's Division of HIV Prevention. Vivent Health is the nation's second largest provider of HIV treatment and prevention services, including here in Milwaukee. WUWM's Eric Von Fellow, Maria Peralta Arellano, is joined by Vivent Health Chief Advocacy Officer Bill Keaton to learn how these cuts could impact our local community.
Here in Wisconsin, you could say we're a low prevalence and a low incidence state. We have about 8,000 people across the state living with HIV. And happy to say that HIV morbidity and mortality, the number of new infections, the number of people who are getting sick from or passing away from HIV is amongst the lowest in the nation. We like to say that people with HIV live longer, healthier lives in Wisconsin than just about any other state in the nation.
Wow. What work has Vivint Health done in respects to putting Wisconsin in that position?
Sure. So one of the things that we did in Wisconsin and what we did at Vivint Health and our predecessor organization, the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, was we developed a model of care that integrated and delivered comprehensive services to people living with HIV. What we know about HIV is that you can take one pill once a day and your prospects for living a very long, healthy life greatly improve, especially if we're able to diagnose someone early in the disease and get them on treatment shortly. But we know there are a lot of barriers to getting engaged with and staying adherent to treatment regimens, things like poverty, food insecurity, unstable housing. So what we did is we made sure to try to bring as many services together, co-locate them, bring them together in one organization so that folks would have access on the same day in the same building when they're going to visit their doctor. They can also see a dentist if they needed one. They can see a mental health therapist if they're struggling with mental health issues or addiction. We also have a pharmacy on site. And then all of the social services that we offer, a food pantry, housing services, legal services, and social work case management, they're all a team-based approach delivering individualized care based on the needs of the folks who are serving. So it's not a cookie-cutter approach or anything like that. And that model of reducing barriers and making sure that when someone shows up and says to their doctor, hey, you know, I lost my job last week. I don't know how I'm going to eat. Instead of a doctor being in a position of saying, well, I'm really sorry to hear that, and I hope you find a food pantry, the doctors and nurses in our clinic can say, I'm really sorry to hear that, and then walk them to the food pantry that's in our building.
So could you tell me a little bit more about how HIV affects different marginalized communities, whether it's gender or race or class even?
Sure. So we know that HIV has a disproportionate impact on communities and individuals who are coming from primarily socioeconomic disadvantage. Unfortunately, in that country, oftentimes that means communities of color and people of color, and it means folks in the LGBTQIA community. And that was true in the early days of the pandemic and the epidemic around HIV. It's unfortunately still true today. We continue to see attacks on folks from the LGBTQ community. We continue to see a regressive policy as it relates to investment in healthcare access, public health, and public education that disproportionately impact communities and people of color. And so HIV is, in that regard, no different. It thrives in environments where there is racism, classism, homophobia, socioeconomic disadvantage. And what we know, unfortunately, is that today in America and throughout the state, those isms, if you will, continue to perpetuate and continue to have an impact on especially young folks and folks of color.
And that was a good segue into my next question. A big part of the reason why we're here is because I received an email, and it was talking about potential cuts coming from the Trump administration. We're looking at potential cuts to HIV prevention in the CDC. What's at stake for Wisconsin? What could we lose? And in your experience, what could happen if this does?
Yeah. So statewide, Vivint Health provides prevention services, preventative services to a number of folks across the state. And they're folks who are all, as I said earlier, coming from vulnerable and marginalized communities. Young folks of color, young folks of color who happen to be part of the LGBTQ community, folks who use drugs, especially folks who are using opioids and are using injection drugs. We receive about $1.9 million that originates from the CDC through our partnership with the state of Wisconsin to deliver those services across the state. And about $1.2 to $1.3 million of that is designed to reach folks here in the Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin area. Why prevention is so important is because at the core of prevention is HIV testing. What we know is that if we can identify folks who have undiagnosed HIV, we can then quickly link them into care, get them on the medications that are effective at managing their HIV, and help them reach what's known as an undetectable viral load or durable viral suppression. What that means is the person is managing their HIV as well as possible, reducing the amount of HIV in their system to really, really low levels. They're not cured because there is no cure for HIV. But what it also means is that they're physiologically unable to transmit HIV to somebody else. So testing becomes the cornerstone of identifying new cases of HIV, helping those individuals quickly get on treatment, and then preventing further transmission of HIV in our community. And so, you know, how do we get people to those testing services? We do things like education. We're doing community-based education as much as possible, going to health fairs, partnering with churches, going to community festivals, going anywhere where there's going to be a congregation of folks who we can reach and provide education and then resources. So those resources might be in the form of condoms and safer sex kits. They might be in the form of our safer injection kits that include syringes so that folks don't reuse syringes that have been used by somebody else. We do all that and then also offer testing to make sure that folks are aware of their status. Knowing one's HIV status is probably the most important part of personal protective health as it relates to HIV. We also use these resources to ensure that folks who could benefit from it have access to pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. PrEP is the one pill once a day medication that can help someone who is vulnerable to HIV infection avoid HIV acquisition. Unfortunately, what we know is that awareness about PrEP isn't where it should be, and that includes amongst healthcare providers, but also amongst patients. And we also know the cost is really high. So these services that are funded by the federal government help to make sure that folks are able to access the medications, whether that be through programs and services that help reduce or eliminate the cost of the expensive medications for them, or just navigate their way to finding a provider who can deliver those care and treatment services.
So when we're dealing with federal cuts coming from the federal government, and then it trickles down into local organizations, how do those cuts manifest?
Yeah, it's a great question. The unfortunate answer is we really don't know. We, as an organization, could receive a letter tomorrow from whether it's the federal government related to the direct federal funding we receive or from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services saying that, you know, due to changes in administration priorities, the specific program is no longer funded. And there you go. What we do know is that we've got contracts signed in a lot of instances. So we're not to hide behind lawyers, but we've got a contract and we agreed and the federal government agreed or the state government agreed for us to deliver certain services to the folks who we're trying to reach in the state of Wisconsin. And so undoing that contract requires, of course, various steps to be completed. So I would imagine that in some instances, this could be a drawn-out battle. But at the end of the day, what it means is if the $1.9 million in CDC-derived funding that Vivant Health receives goes away, we're going to be unable to sustain the level of services and reach the number of people we need to reach to continue to successfully address the HIV epidemic in the state of Wisconsin. And that's really unfortunate because we know these programs are working. New HIV infection diagnoses have been going down for the last several years. It was actually under the first administration of President Trump where we started some of the national coordinating efforts, the ending the epidemic plans and stay prepped up that helped to deliver PrEP and make sure everyone had access to it. It was helping to ensure there was coordination and response and that additional resources were flowing to individuals and communities that needed them most. We're seeing now the results, and they're positive. Less new HIV diagnoses, people with HIV living longer, healthier lives. These programs are working. We can reasonably talk about getting to an end of the HIV epidemic. And by that, I mean having the number of new diagnoses fall below a certain threshold that epidemiologists will determine. But we can reasonably talk about ending HIV as an epidemic in this nation probably by 2030 or 2035 if we continue to invest in the programs that are currently working. Now is not the time to go backwards and set us back decades as we try and reach a goal that I think everyone, regardless of political affiliation, would agree is a noble goal, and that's ending one of the more destructive pandemics that has impacted humanity for the last 40 years.
And I like how you brought up the contracts. You guys have that legal backing with the government and our state government. Is there any other way that you guys could prepare for these cuts if they were to happen, or is it just relying on the protections of your legal team, or would there be spots for community support? Would that be enough to uphold organizations such as yourself or even smaller ones?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think if we look at it on the national level, we're talking about roughly $1 billion. That is a really large hole to fill if we're going to be relying on private philanthropy and maybe state or local governments to fill that hole. We know at the state level here in Wisconsin, unfortunately, Wisconsin has been one of the states that has invested the least per capita in public health programming when compared to all of the other states in the nation. So stepping in to fill these holes is going to require a lot of folks stepping up to do it. And it makes me very anxious for us to be able to continue to achieve the successes we're achieving without the investment of the federal government.
And that's understandable, the anxiety with everything being so unstable and uncertain. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about the people that you guys serve as well. I did read a good majority of the people that you guys serve are on Medicare or Medicaid. So how are other potential funding cuts interacting with potential cuts to the CDC?
Yeah, when it comes to things like Medicaid and Medicare, you know, those are the two largest sources of healthcare coverage for people living with HIV in the United States. Changes to either one of those programs would be incredibly disruptive, not only for the organizations that are providing care, but for the individuals who are relying on those two critical programs to help defray or eliminate the costs of their healthcare. The cost of medications for people living with HIV can be between $2,000 and $3,000 a month. Given that 90% of the people we serve are living at or below 200% of the federal poverty limit, individuals who would lose access to healthcare coverage through Medicaid or Medicare, or have their coverage benefits severely limited or reduced in scope through things like block granting Medicaid or changing it to a per capita program, I struggle to imagine a way in which someone who's living at 200% of FPL who loses their access to Medicaid would be able to afford medications that will keep them alive, especially if they cost between $2,000 and $3,000 a month.
Bill Keaton is the Chief Advocacy Officer at Vivant Health. He spoke with WUWM Eric Von Fellow, Maria Peralta Arellano. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn about the Milwaukee Public Library's collection of zines, often DIY publications about everything from punk music to birds. But first, a delay in testing rape kits has become an attack line in the state Supreme Court race. We'll learn about those kits and how they're used next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In the flurry of ads for the state Supreme Court race, you may have seen ones about the timely testing of rape and sexual assault kits. When candidate Judge Brad Schimel was state attorney general, there was a backlog of thousands of rape kits, for which he's been criticized by his opponent, Judge Susan Crawford. For a better understanding of the use of these kits, we turn to the Women's Center in Waukesha. The nonprofit serves clients who have been victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and human trafficking. The center's Jesse Trouth tells WUWM's Chuck Quernbach about how someone who has suffered unwanted sexual contact might be tested. And a note to our listeners, this conversation includes descriptions of sexual assault.
And they can go to a hospital, and there's a specially trained nurse called a SANE nurse, a sexual assault nurse examiner. And they're trained in the evidence collection. So not only do they know how to have those really hard conversations with victims in a really sensitive way, they know how to collect evidence so that it can be used later in court if the individual decides to report to law enforcement. And being preventative with the possibility of sexually transmitted infections or things like that. So they can just be checking for external injuries. They can do internal swabs. They can collect as much as the victim is comfortable with. And all along the way, the nurse is asking for consent and checking in to make sure this is what the victim wants.
Cotton swabs are part of the kit. What else is in the kit, so to speak?
There can be combs that can go through hair or other places to collect microscopic evidence. Sometimes there's urine samples. Sometimes there's other samples taken. It just depends on the type of harm that was done to the individual, right? It removes some of the opinion pieces from it. Or when trauma happens to us, our memory isn't always the strongest, right? So even if we can't remember all of the details, this science is able to say that this is what happened.
The DNA science, is that the...
Correct, yes, the DNA science.
Okay. It typically takes a while to test.
So if a rape kit is being tested, the hospital or law enforcement is supposed to send it to the crime lab within about 72 hours. From there, it takes anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks for those tests to be conducted. That is separate from if there's a sexually transmitted infection test or a pregnancy test, or that's completely separate. But if you're looking at the DNA testing right now, it's taking about 4 to 6 weeks.
How can it help move the legal process along later on?
So if the individual's DNA is known, if it's in any of the systems, right, it can lead to an arrest, it can help with the prosecution, and it can minimize the amount of time that a trial or a court event would take.
Faster for the victim, potentially.
Yes.
Okay. But we should make it clear that it's not a 24-hour thing like we see on TV or less, right? A 24-minute.
Correct. The TV shows and movies provide a false narrative. It's a process. It takes some time. And that also is one of the reasons why folks may not always report. There's lots of reasons, including safety, stigmas that surround it, fear of being blamed or shamed, but also the fact that you have a long time of waiting. And just because the kit is tested in 4 to 6 weeks, that doesn't mean that the court process is done.
No, because there's motions and preliminary appearances.
Right. And in some cases, the perpetrator is unknown, so they also have to identify them and arrest them. So it can be a long, hard process where you're reliving your story and your trauma for multiple entities and multiple folks.
So is it important to have a rape kit, A, availability, B, system that works given its time limitations? Is it important to be able to offer this to folks?
It's extremely important for folks to be able to have this option. One, it creates a greater sense of safety for some individuals. It also allows for there to be the perpetrators and the harm doers held accountable. You know, so it's the only way that victims are able to have an option is if these are available and if they're conducted in a timely and efficient manner. And you have the right to have an advocate with you every step of the way, whether that's at the hospital or speaking with law enforcement. Even if an individual is unsure if they want to have their kit tested, it can be stored at the crime lab for up to 10 years. Law enforcement does ask that an individual make a decision about 6 months before that 10-year mark so that they have time to test it in that. But that's one of the reasons why it provides additional options for folks is you don't have to make that decision right away. You can have the evidence collected and safely stored. You can also sign up and opt in for notifications so that you know what your timeline is, as well as any time your kit is being moved. So when it's being transported, when it's being tested, any of those pieces are available if you opt into that notification system.
Why is there a 10-year window? Sometimes crimes takes that long to solve crimes or assaults?
Yes, but also the 10 years means that they can decide at that point. So you could have the evidence collected now and really think about what you want to do with it. Maybe as, you know, a 22-year-old, you aren't sure that you want to go through the whole legal process. But as you're approaching 28, 29, 30 with more or different lived experiences, you may say, you know, I want to move forward with this now. So it gives them the opportunity to make a different decision later.
There could be trauma that sort of takes a while to appear in a person.
Absolutely, that can be part of it as well. It can also be the fear and uncertainty that occurs right after the event of not knowing what's going to be the safest option for me. So this alleviates that concern and allows folks to have some time to decide what's best for them.
Law enforcement, it would cost money to test. It would be not helpful.
Well, a victim can have the evidence collected and still not choose to report their information to law enforcement. So again, you can go to the hospital and have all of the evidence collected and have it stored and never involve law enforcement. And you could decide that that's something you want to do later on. The reason it isn't tested is that the victim gets to decide what happens to those items. Again, the exception is with minors, but the victim has the right to make the decision of if they want that to move forward or not. And so that's why it's left in their hands that way and why it's not tested preemptively.
Anything else?
We know that this is a hard and scary time, and however we can be a resource and a support, we're happy to be there. We have staff that are available 24 hours to talk to. And we just would like victims to know you're not alone. There are lots of people that believe you and support you and are ready to help you along whatever path you're taking.
Jesse Trouth is Director of Shelter and Transitional Living at the Women's Center in Waukesha. She spoke with WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. Coming up next in our Books and Beyond series, we'll explore zines. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The library is more than just books. And our series with the Milwaukee Public Library called Books and Beyond showcases just that. We share resources, book recommendations, and some cool stuff you might not know about. Today we're learning about the world of zines, like the end of the word magazines. Zines are typically independently published materials, often intended for self-expression. They're usually produced in small quantities, which makes collecting them an interesting challenge. The Milwaukee Public Library has a growing zine collection in the Rare Books Room at Central Library. They get materials through Milwaukee Zine Fest as well as personal donations. To learn more about zines, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited with Rare Books librarian Timothy Rush.
So I imagine the writings and the graphics, all these materials can range so much. So can you kind of describe what a typical zine is made up of and why the library collects them?
So the idea of a typical zine is actually hard to nail down because zines are so personal. We have zines in this collection that are just drawings of axolotls. We have zines in this collection that are somebody's reviews of Milwaukee's punk scene from the 1970s and 80s, and it's just him reviewing every punk album or single that came out in Milwaukee. It's a single sheet of paper covered in text, and it's all typewritten and photocopied. And then you have, you know, issues of a zine called Pro Wrestling Feelings that was published out of Chicago that is just people's deeply emotional resonance with different professional wrestling topics. So zines are about self-expression. So these are people expressing themselves and their topics in different ways. Zines started out with the like fanzine movement of the 40s and 50s, which is science fiction fans deciding, well, no one's publishing stuff for us, so we're going to start putting it out ourselves. And that starts a lot of fictional commentary, and but even also just writing short stories and spec scripts and sharing them amongst other fans, because that's the way that you grow that audience. And eventually a lot of those fanzine writers would go on to be professional writers of different sorts. Gene DeWeese, who's actually on our Wisconsin Writer Hall of Fame, shows up a lot in a lot of our zines that we've collected, because that's what he was writing before he became a professional science fiction writer.
I love that. And while you say it's very individualistic and ranges in topic, but kind of a through line is an overall DIY creative culture, right?
Oh, absolutely. Like this zine movement, especially like when it comes to modern zines, it is, I'm going to put out this idea so that I can control what's being said. I can make sure to express myself and no one can tell me, no, that's not what we're going to publish. And our collection is typically collected through a local event, Zine Fest, which is a partnership between the library itself and The Bindery, which is a local business down in the Bayview area. They typically do, unsurprisingly, binding and other book-related materials and, you know, inspiring creatives. And that's what this is so we get those items that are from the folks that come to Zine Fest to exhibit their zines, and then they donate those to the library itself. And that allows us to collect these like voices that you would not typically get in traditional publishing. And that allows us to save them for future generations by preserving these, like, you know, one of only 20 little images or zines that were produced by local folks. Almost all of these folks are at the very least from the Midwest, but Zine Fest actually is at minimum 50% like Milwaukee and surrounding area.
That's great. And I know there's obviously a lot of different local collections here at the library and in the rare books room itself. And you gave some background on how you've been collecting this material. Can you describe the volume? We've talked about the range of kind of topics and things that are covered, but, you know, how does this zine collection compare to the other rare book holdings that are here?
So in terms of pure size, like we hold less than, say, 900 zines total. And that's across both the general zine collection and a recent special collection of fanzines that we were able to add via donation as well. And that is only a small drop in the bucket, even for a small collection like the Rare Books Room, which is over 18,000 items. And also, typically, these are all quite small. At maximum, these are maybe 20, 30 pages stapled together. Some of the main bulk of the collection is not even large zines like that, but are like single-page newsletters and that sort of thing. So it is a small fraction of what we have here in the collection, but it exemplifies a lot of different voices that are not otherwise exhibited in the collection.
One aspect of the zine collection that you recently acquired is the Leah Fisher Science Fiction and Fantasy Fanzine Collection. Can you share more about that and what makes getting this collection so special and exciting for you?
So this was a really fun opportunity that kind of just landed in our lap. Through a partnership, we work with UWM and their head of special collections, Max Yalo, very closely as a peer in the community. And Max Yalo had a collection that he said, please get this out of my office. he had accepted it as a donation probably like 15 years ago. And he was like, I think it would have a better home at MPL. And I was more than happy to accept it because we already have a large zine collection. And this turned out to be a collection that had been donated to UWM by a former MPL librarian.
Oh, full circle.
Leah Fisher was, she worked at a variety of branches and then eventually ended her career here at the Wisconsin Talking Book and Braille Library and was very involved with the science fiction scene here in Milwaukee. And so she had collected these over, you know, decades. A lot of the zines that we got through ZineFest are modern. They have been produced in the last decade or so. ZineFest has existed for about 17 years now. And these go back all the way to, the majority of the zines are from like the 80s and 90s, but some go back as early as the 70s, as well as material that was produced in the 60s as well. And so this gives us a large breadth of these sort of subcultures, both local and far-reaching. A lot of it is based in Illinois, and a lot of it is from Milwaukee, which was really great to have. But there are zines from like six different non-American countries that are exhibited in here. She did a really good job of collecting a large swath of different places and ideas, though all centered around fantasy and science fiction.
As we're talking about zines, the comparison, and granted it's not a one-to-one, but I think of zines persevering pre-internet, during internet, and where we are now, where we're just sharing everything. Like, you know, zine could have been people's first Tumblr before we were on Tumblr posting poems or drawings or other things like that. How do you see zines as like something that's persisted through time?
Oh, absolutely. So that's part of the interesting thing that you see is that by having a larger swath of history, especially going through the dawn of the internet age, you watch as these zines go from mimeographed pages. And if you don't know what a mimeograph machine is, don't worry, I didn't know before I started working with this. But it's this sort of like hand-cranked little, like almost Xerox machine that could only produce these like very like purplish colors onto paper. And they would be using these to, they'd have to make stencils so that they could print out multiple copies. And you go from this to the photocopies to, you know, people using early word processors. We even have a couple of things that are in the collection that technically aren't zines. They were printed out fan fiction from old bulletin board systems. And printed on dot matrix paper with the strips of holes on the side, which that hits me right in the childhood myself. Mm-hmm. But it's just this wonderful little slice of history. And then you hit the internet age, and suddenly everyone's got email addresses, and things get smaller, and they link to more websites rather than providing content in the zines themselves. But you then start getting a big push now into art and artistic expression, because the ability to print art becomes easier and reproduce art becomes even more fascinating and greater. And that's especially like if you were to come to ZineFest today, it is such a visual treat just to see all of the different vendors and all the art and all the different types of expression that folks have. And that is really thriving.
So there's obviously such a big range, but off the top of your head, what comes to your mind as a favorite zine or publication?
Oh, so in terms of favorite zines, I have a rather crude favorite, which is there is somebody who made a zine, and it is shaped like it's a like 2002 class project of why Sonic the Hedgehog is great. And the interior cover of this zine is just this crude hand drawing of Sonic the Hedgehog kicking Mario in the groin. And it is the silliest thing that was somehow added to the Rare Books collection. And it brings me such joy that something so silly is preserved in this collection. Just last year at ZineFest, I finally encountered the person who had made it. And as much as I wanted to ask him why, I was like, I can't. The mystery of this is too important to me. I don't want to know why this exists. I'm just happy that you're here, and I want you to go see where it's currently sitting on exhibit behind the glass. And at that time, because we host MIAD classes who visit for their history of design, it was exhibited behind the glass in Rarities next to an Alphonse Mucha poster. On a more serious note, so we have a lot. One of the really great things that we have is we have an active subscription to Moody, which is a local publication of artists who are producing this zine monthly. And it's got these beautiful covers, often mimeographed as well, with these bright, beautiful colors. And it is great to get something that is being produced on a small scale in Milwaukee and keep it and preserve it. And that is one of our big goals here with the Rare Books Collection. Obviously, we have big, fancy things like the James Audubon Birds of America and all of those big ticket, major historical items. But part of our goal is preserving local history for the future. And so collecting like zines and little artistic expressions and carrying those forward, you get to discover all of these different things that otherwise wouldn't be preserved. And that's, you know, that's what we're here for.
Well, from the silly to the profound, I look forward to exploring the many zines you have here. And Timothy, thank you so much for talking to me about them today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to be here.
Timothy Rush is the Rare Books Librarian at the Milwaukee Public Central Library. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for this month's Books and Beyond. You can see photos of some of the zines they talked about, as well as explore past Books and Beyond stories at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. What's in a name? Tomorrow on Lake Effect, listen closely to our special April Fool's episode with a hidden Easter egg and no misinformation. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.